From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The acting head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration shared a new vision for that agency at a recent Department of Commerce meeting. His presentation was leaked to the Union of Concerned Scientists and then certain members of the media, including Living Lab Radio. What has drawn the most attention is the fact that the word climate was dropped from the NOAA mission statement, and that conservation of ecosystems and natural resources was replaced by economic development and national security. Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet responded to media coverage by issuing a statement saying that the newly proposed mission statement, quote, was not intended to exclude NOAA's important climate and conservation efforts, which are essential for protecting lives and the environment, nor should this presentation be considered a final vetted proposal, end quote. But Andrew Rosenberg of the Union of Concerned Scientists and a former NOAA scientist and manager says that the presentation was an explicit declaration of where NOAA is headed under the Trump administration.
It's sending a strong signal not only to the employees, but to Congress, to the public, and to partners, national and international, that the direction for the agency is fundamentally changing.
That presentation also included a number of goals and initiatives relating to weather forecasting, fisheries management, and marine protected areas. We will be digging into a number of those in coming weeks, starting next week with the pros and cons of trying to triple aquaculture production in the next decade. Today, we're going to start with some science that may help us understand the divide over President Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy. While the majority of Americans found the practice of separating families at the border objectionable, some have said inhumane, about a quarter of Americans supported the practice. My next guest sees echoes of other colonial policies that stemmed from a belief that the people involved were less evolved, not fully human. It's an attitude that we have often equated with an extreme version of dislike, but new research debunks that idea and points to possible ways of changing such views. Emile Bruneau is director of the Peace and Conflict Neuroscience Lab at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. Emile, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
What is the difference between disliking someone and considering that person less than human?
Well, we've been doing a lot of research on this to figure out exactly that. I think the first step is to just determine if they are in fact distinct. We have developed a measure to assess levels of blatant dehumanization that people hold towards others. And we've done this in a number of ways. One of the ways is to just give people the ascent of man diagram inspired by Darwin.
That's the picture essentially of with each step, it progresses from something more chimp or ape-like up
right,
to something
that's... a quadrupedal human ancestor up to the modern, what you might refer to as modern human. So we give them this image, and then we just list groups underneath, and we ask people to use a little slider to indicate where they think each group falls on that evolutionary progression. And so we did this because there was a general assumption that blatant dehumanization might have just been a thing of the past, that it was there for colonialism and slavery, but that we didn't really hold these views widely, and we wanted to test that. And what we found was that now in a number of different contexts across three different continents, at least a dozen different countries, we find that groups in those countries are perfectly willing to report that their group is more evolved and civilized than other groups, particularly marginalized groups. So the self-report is there. But then the concern is still, well, maybe people are just using this scale to express their extreme dislike for these groups.
And how would you tease that apart?
Well, one way to tease it apart is to look in people's brains as they're making evaluations of dislike and making evaluations using this scale. And the assumption would be that if these are similar processes, that you would see activity in similar brain regions, or at least overlapping brain regions. And what we found when we had people do this, so we had people in the scanner rate different groups on this scale, the ascent dehumanization scale, and also on a standard scale of dislike towards other groups, a feeling thermometer. So we had them rate the same groups on these different scales. And we found not only was there no overlap, but there was what we call a double dissociation. That is, the brain regions that were active when people were dehumanizing these other groups were completely insensitive when people were doing the task with the feeling thermometer, and the brain region that was active when they were registering their dislike was completely insensitive when they were making their ratings on the dehumanization scale.
I think we've all experienced disliking someone who we clearly consider to be just as human and civilized as we are. We're capable of understanding that distinction. Is it possible to view someone, though, as less than human, less evolved, if you will, without disliking that person?
Yeah, I think a lot of colonial policies, traditionally, you know, the separation of children from their families is not a new phenomenon. That has been going on for a long time. In fact, it was going on in Australia up until the 1970s of removing Aboriginal children from their families. And oftentimes, people who were doing this were citing the welfare of the children as the motivation to do this. And I've heard this similar sentiments expressed for the current policy in the southern border. If you think that children are being used to get into the country, then you might think that separating them from their families is actually in their welfare. And we've also actually examined this in another context where I think this is really common is in education. So teachers might deny certain students access to higher education by placing them in lower educational tracks. They might do it for their own good, right? Supposedly because they don't think the kid will be able to handle that type of academic rigor. And if you do this on a per student basis, you know, you would refer to this as paternalism. I don't think it's necessarily pejorative here. It makes sense that a teacher would have a paternalistic attitude towards a student. But we've found that this is true across ethnic boundaries. So that teachers in Hungary, for example, systematically place Roma students from the Roma minority population into lower educational tracks, even though we had manipulated it so that their scores were identical to the non-Roma students. So even Roma students who are identically qualified were placed selectively into lower educational tracks. And the degree to which teachers did this was predicted by their dehumanization of the Roma and not by their dislike of the Roma. In fact, the teachers that did this the most were the teachers who simultaneously felt the warmest towards the Roma in general and dehumanized them. So I think this is one of those clear indications of paternalism driving attitudes towards another group.
Does it matter that dislike is separate from dehumanization? I mean, it seems that it's the dehumanization part that is leading to perhaps the most conflict, even more than dislike.
Yeah, well, I think it's important for a number of reasons. So the reason I'm doing this research is to develop interventions to reduce hostility between groups. And the fact that dehumanization and dislike are distinct from each other matters to me because if I'm trying to build interventions, I might want to target either dehumanization or dislike or both. And it might be important that they're distinct because I might be able to decrease someone's hostility towards another group, their prejudice towards another group, but that might not affect their dehumanization. And if dehumanization is really what's driving people's policy choices and their voting behavior, then I might want to look at other interventions that specifically target dehumanization. And I think in many circumstances, dehumanization is the prime driver. That we examined this, for example, with resistance to the Iran nuclear accord and found that dehumanization was a stronger predictor of people's resistance to the Iran nuclear accord than was dislike. So this seems incredibly relevant to many different kind of important real world situations.
And has your research turned up possible interventions that can get people past these kinds of dehumanizing attitudes?
Yeah. We do have some really promising results. So one of maybe the important differences between dehumanization and dislike is dehumanization often seems to be driven by our perceptions of the other group, what we believe to be true about them, or what we think they think of us. So, for example, I've just been doing some research about the situation on the southern border and found that one of the biggest predictors of how much people dehumanize refugees or migrants that are coming to our southern border is the perception of the percentage of them that are gang members. So Democrats estimate that about 10% of the migrants coming to our southern border are members of MS-13 or other gangs. Republicans estimate it's about 24%. Hmm. And the actual numbers from the Department of Homeland Security is about 1%. So both groups are dramatically overestimating, and that estimate feeds into their dehumanization of these groups. And that, in turn, feeds into their resistance to allowing these migrants to come into our country and their support for policies like removing their children from them. So this dehumanization, if it's fed by these perceptions and not by your dislike of the other group, I feel like the perceptions are things that we can change because they're verifiably false. And so that gives me some hope that we can implement some of these interventions to specifically target those beliefs that are just verifiably erroneous. And another approach that we've used is, maybe in concert with dehumanization, there's a tendency to generalize from the negative actions of a group member. So if someone from another group does something really horrible, like someone who's Muslim commits an act of terrorism, there's a tendency to attribute that to the group as a whole, to collectively blame all Muslims for what that individual Muslim extremist did. And there's not the same tendency to attribute that across boundaries if they're Christian or if they're white. So if someone who's Christian or white does something really terrible and kills people in an act of terrorism, we don't think all white people or all Christians are responsible. And we've been able to use this just in a little interactive activity to reduce people's tendency to blame Muslims just by kind of bringing out this inherent hypocrisy they have within them without being accusatory or shaming them. And if we kind of reveal this hypocrisy, people can then correct it. And we found that this has been really effective at decreasing not just the degree to which people collectively blame Muslims for an act of for an action by a Muslim extremist, but also their dehumanization of Muslims. And this has been really effective in the US, in Spain also, and it also affects their behavior even a month after doing this little activity.
Does your research looking at these attitudes, as you've already said, across continents, across people, finding that dehumanizing views of other groups are such a pervasive aspect of human societies, but then also looking at these possible interventions, on the balance, does your research leave you feeling a little depressed about the state of humanity or optimistic about our potential to change?
Do I have to choose one of those answers?
I guess both are possible, right?
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, when the data come in for looking at the degrees of dehumanization across group boundaries, yeah, the data are beautiful and they're completely depressing. So that part of it is really miserable. But the fact that we can implement some really simple interventions and see measurable change, that's really exciting. So in a way, you know, it's horrendous that this view exists. But in many ways, I feel like dehumanization is something that's more malleable. It's easier to change in people than is dislike. So in that way, I guess it also gives some hope.
Emile Bruneau is director of the Peace and Conflict Neuroscience Lab at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication and co-author of a new study in the Journal of Experimental Psychology finding that dehumanization and dislike are actually different brain processes. Emile, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Up next, why Americans smile more than Russians. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.